Radio City, John Grayson, Rob Ross, once again going into the world of popular culture and dissecting it as we do each and every week here on Poptos. And Rob, how's everything going?
Scoobity boop. Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah.
How is it people don't know that that's fucking Superstone?
Yeah, oh, I know. It was one of the best episodes of the Flintstones ever, and still and all, it seems to have been lost on a lot of folks in pop. You know, that we need more cartoons in our lives. That's what this comes down to.
Well, that's the problem with the modern generation and the niceties of all this, you know. Oh, cartoons have to be educational.
Right.
And, you know, bullshit. They have to be funny. That's the whole point. They're there to entertain us and to actually give us our introduction into pop culture.
Yeah.
Top 5 Flintstones episodes. Obviously, the one with the Swedish musicians.
Yes.
No question about it. Yabba dabba dabba doo. The Flintstone Frantic featuring the Bo Brummelstones.
The Way Outs.
Obviously Superstone,
yep.
And Nice and Slow. See,
that's
the way
you
to do it.
Nice and Slow. Oh, could not agree more. And I mean, when it comes to the older cartoons like that, we went through. The problem is, it's the Beatles and Stones thing again. They drove each other. The competition was there. They liked each other, but they drove each other to create better music. And it was the same thing with Warner Brothers and Disney back in the day. They were pushing each other to create better stuff. And then somewhere along the way, it all fell apart, and cartoons became a vehicle to sell shit. Oh, here, buy our product, buy our cereal, buy our little action figures. And now, as you said, it's turned a corner again, but the corner that it turned was into, oh, let's give a moral lesson. Let's teach everybody something. No. Let's go back to the days when it was pure entertainment.
Cartoons became a vehicle for sales, certainly in the 50s and then really in the 60s because of the advent and then rise of television.
Yep.
But now it's turned into what you and I have branded before, pussification. You know, turning our children into namby-pambies, it's like everything has to be padded and helmeted. And you know what? When I rode a bicycle and fell off, you know what I did? I went, ow,
yep.
Cursed, maybe cried a little bit, bled, wiped my hand on my pants, and got back on my bicycle.
And went,
end of story.
Right. And you went and tried to do that thing again that you hurt yourself doing because you know you can
right.
get it right.
Right. If I fell off the monkey bars in the schoolyard, you know what? Okay, you take me to the hospital, put a stitch in, and put me back out on again.
Yeah.
It's kind of the throwing the kid off the end of the pier and letting the little bastard swim. If he doesn't swim, okay, hard cheese. You know, he drowns. C'est la vie.
Yep.
What are you going to do? Are we going to namby-pamby everything? I guess so. But I want to talk about one little element because about a week or so ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, there was this wonderful – and I do mean – I want to say – one of those moments when Facebook actually serves the purpose that it was created for, to connect and entertain.
Mm-hmm.
There's a wonderful, wonderful thread on Peter Holsapple's page where he was talking about the beauty and just abject joy of Warner Brothers cartoons that we all grew up with. So we were all reminiscing about our favorite moments. Like I shared Book Review with them, and of course I love Tasinga. You know,
right.
When people were bringing up, What's Opera Doc? And just, I cannot tell you how many people had fun doing this. And even Peter, as the one who had just begun the thread, seemed to be very warmed by it. That's when you start to feel the blood bump again from something like that. Those
yeah.
kinds of huge conversations. But at the same time, it also made me think of and bring up during that thread, apart from Warner Brothers and apart from Disney, you know, in those early days, you had Paramount and Fleischer Studios doing Popeye, of
mm-hmm.
course.
Right.
The two, I should say, that people tend to forget the most are UPA, who did Mr. Magoo.
Yep.
And Gerald McBoing-Boing and so on. And Terry Toons, who originally were part of Fox and then became part of CBS. When they went from being movie-owned to television-owned. And Terry Toons gave us Mighty Mouse, Heckle and Jekyll, Deputy Dog, and of course my personal favorite, Hector Heathcote. So you did have a really healthy mix of studios that were doing their thing. And of course, Hanna and Barbera had worked for MGM when MGM were doing the Tom and Jerry cartoons.
Yep.
So they went off, branched into their own thing, created shows like, of course, the first one that they did was Rough and Ready with Pixie and Dixie and Mr. Jinx.
Right.
Then Huckleberry Hound, and of course, the Flintstones and the Jetsons. But also out of Warner Brothers came Bob Clampett, who went off and created, of course, Beanie and Cecil, which was born of a puppet show.
Right.
So, you know, if you want to put a sense of humor into children, which they are sorely lacking, and I say that in all seriousness, because kids nowadays are already immediately just small adults, which is a very, very sad statement.
Yeah.
You've got to expose them to what was genuinely funny. And I just mean rip-roaringly funny. And again, it goes back to what you and I have talked about X number of times, that we're probably that last generation that get the cultural sub-references that our parents always made from our days of watching the Warner Brothers cartoons.
Right. Well, and two things to add to that. First of all, I was never, when I was a kid, I always gravitated toward the late 40s through the 1950s Warner Brothers stuff, because the colors are a little brighter, the characters were a little more well-developed and refined in terms of the way that they looked, the animation was a little bit better, but there's a couple of exceptions. And the first one was a 38 or 39 Porky Pig cartoon called Porky's Papa. And it was just, I mean, the imagery that they showed. At one point, they're making Swiss cheese, and all of the little holes in the Swiss cheese turn into mouths and start singing the song. It was just so weird that it appealed to me even as a little tiny kid. So that was one. But then later on, you know, we've talked before about the music and the fact that, well, even with What's Opera, Doc, we wouldn't have known anything about opera had it not been for that. All the classical music that was involved in the Warner Brothers cartoons. But the one
that... Are you going to say the Little Bops?
Yes.
I knew it. I got that feeling. First of all, I will take that and bookend it. You pick 1938. I love to sing it as 1937.
There you go.
So that's that period where... They hadn't gotten to Bugs Bunny yet, or Elmer Fudd, or even Daffy Duck, I don't think. And the thing is, they still made it memorable.
Right.
You know? And of course, the cultural norm of the time was, of course, radio. So, you know, Jack Bunny hosting the radio show that little Owl Jolson goes and sings on.
Yep.
Just sheer unadulterated genius. Now, the Three Little Bops, which I think is... I don't remember. It's the 60s. It's the late period when DePatie and Freleng were actually really running the Warner studio before they went off and did the Pink Panther series for United Artists. I don't remember. I'm going to probably have it wrong. It's between 63 and 66, that short. And what I loved about it was done completely musically. It was done with Stan Freberg as your narrator.
Right.
And it was the Three Little Pigs done as a bop tale. Or if you don't know what the word bop means, people, it's jazz lingo, modern jazz lingo, as defined by modern jazz 1947 to 1968. You know, that whole Blue Note, Savoy, Prestige, Atlantic, you know, kind of modern jazz vibe. And, you know, it's a really brilliant retelling of the Three Little Pigs story done in modern jazz.
Yeah, and the great part about it is, and the message is so beautiful, because the wolf, not to do a spoiler here, but I think most of us have already seen this one, he finally learns jazz by going to hell. I mean, how can you get better than that? It's just wonderful.
And you know what the funny thing, full circle of this conversation is with the choices that we picked? What's Papa Owl's famous line to Owl Jolson? You hacha, you crooner, you jazz singer.
Yeah. Oh, and again, it comes full circle 30 years later. So that's the brilliance of these things. And by the way, it's funny because somebody out there knows this about us and recognized the fact that we didn't want to go buy action figures, because you look at the stuff where the originality is now, where you had... a sort of a resurgence of it in the late 90s with the early SpongeBob stuff. And then, of course, that turned into a huge marketing campaign. But I don't think that was the creator's fault. I think that just sort of happened. But you also had Johnny Bravo and a couple of other interesting cartoons that were starting to pop up. But now it's all about Adult Swim. And the stuff that's on way late at night that's directed at us, not at the kids at all. And things like Archer that's just brilliant. And... you know, so it's still out there, But you're right. What needs to happen is that same kind of creativity needs to happen and aim itself back at 3, 4, 5, all the way up to 13, 14, 15-year-olds.
You know, the bottom line is if you look at Saturday mornings, there's no more cartoons. Now there's a mandate.
Yep.
It's absolutely – it's law that you have to have educational programming on every channel for a certain period of time. That was nonsense when we were kids,
yep.
You know, because that's what public TV was there for. You know, we would watch anything and everything from the Wacky Races to the Hudson Brothers Razzle Dazzle show till CBS came on with the CBS Children's Film Festival at around noon, which was then you knew, okay, you know, the cartoons are wrapping up, and that means we're getting either dragged out to go grocery shopping with our parents or off to grandma's house. So let the weekly Saturday torture begin. We've had our Saturdays of joy. Now it's time for the usual childhood miseries.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And Sunday mornings, of course, were occupied by 3 hours of shit known as Wonderama. And the reason we watched Wonderama was because of the fucking cartoons. That was the only way we would get them.
Right. Yeah, and there was still room for a little bit of lessening and that sort of thing here and there, because you had, I forget which church it was, the Presbyterians or somebody like that, who were behind Davy and Goliath, which granted wasn't a cartoon, but it was still animated. And it, you know, those things, even barring, you know, the messaging and everything else that was in there, they were entertaining. They were fun to watch.
Right. I mean, it's interesting because Art Clokey, who did, of course, Gumby, was the one who did Davy and Goliath as well. And that was on at 7 o'clock in the morning on ABC, followed by, I don't know if you remember this one. It was on very briefly. It was a cartoon called Jot. And it was just this little dot with a face, like a smiling face, and you could talk and arms and legs. And then 7 to 8 o'clock, which was always the dry hour, so to speak, you know, and if you were up at 7 o'clock, then you had no choice but to watch this because there was no other form of animation on. And then Wanderama came on and Bob McAllister tortured us and just, you know, God, those 70s feel good about me kind of horseshit things. Look, just get to the cartoons.
Right. Okay? Exactly. Yeah. You know why we're here.
Right. Get to the heart of the matter and let me go, because 11 o'clock means either I'm going to get stuck watching Abbott and Costello or worse yet. What was it? Sammy Perillo and Duke, what's his name, meet the Brooklyn Gorilla. It was always some crappy movie on at 11 o'clock. It was either that or the Bowery Boys, and I sure as shit didn't want to sit through any of that kind of crap.
Yeah, really. Give me more Hunts Hall. That's what I need in my life. Now,
if I want Hunts Hall, I'll go listen to Cheap Trick.
Attaboy. So we've got a whole bunch going on in the world, and the world again started to fall apart over the weekend because Charlottesville happened.
What Charlottesville where?
What kind of... Yeah, University of Virginia.
Bunker nowadays.
Yeah, it's been insane to watch what's happened here. And I mean, it's as simple as this. You remember the good old days when the Nazis were just called the enemy?
Sure, and I also remember when Nazis were simply, the word Nazi referred to Germans.
Yeah, right. Yeah, not guys who were... and now we've got these idiots showing up in Charlottesville to protest the removal of a Confederate statue. And I don't know how many times I have to say this, but why are we the only country in the world that erects statues to the side that lost?
A side that could be considered, and I'm speaking strictly in semantics here, and I don't like it if there are anti-Semites out there that will, will castigate me for this, but the fact is they could be looked upon as traitors.
Yep. Now, oh, yeah, they were seditious. Absolutely.
In any other country, you know, these people are reviled. You know, you hear their names, you know, Guy Fawkes. Do I really need, even though I hate the English, you know, all I have to do is say Guy Fawkes, and what happens? You burn him in effigy.
Right.
Right? Robert E. Lee was a traitor. His grandfather, or maybe it was his father, Henry Lighthorse Lee, was one of the founders of these here United Colonies, which became the United States of America.
Right.
It was he who had gotten the resolution talked about in Congress in Philadelphia in 1776. So everything that Henry Lighthorse Lee had done, his son led the opposition to.
Yeah.
Which is appalling.
Right.
Now, how you can consider him a heroic figure is still mystifying to me. Now, having said that, okay, let me play devil's advocate here. There are people out there who still want to maintain certain, quote, Southern traditions. You want to still revere Robert E. Lee. You want to still revere and wave the Confederate flag. Do so in your own private spaces.
Yep.
The United States is one flag, one nation, and that particular flag is called the Stars and Stripes, not the Stars and Bars. I'm not being sarcastic. This is very clear. This is called common sense. And I don't understand how and why nobody, especially this so-called enlightened younger generation, all these millennials, don't seem to grasp any of this. Now, at the same time, I look at the characters that were in yesterday's little march with the tiki lamps that they got, tiki torches that they got from Home Depot, made in China.
Yeah, right.
Wear their polo shirts and khakis. Look to me like a bunch of, you know, overprivileged modern versions of the Socs. Now, say what you will, these people are obviously well-to-do, incredibly ignorant, but the key thing is, you know, they all come from money somehow. This
right.
is not some ragtag band of, you know, workers who are struggling. This is a group of the overprivileged.
Yeah, and then you look at who shows up to be their muscle a day later when things start to go south, and it's Duck Dynasty with fucking automatic rifles. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And these guys all look like they're about two ribs away from a heart exploding, and, you know, they're carrying their rifles down the street with their camo on, and it's like, you know, can you idiots go back to playing freeze tag in the woods and whatever else it is you do out there? But at the heart of all of this, you know, again, in steps the President of the United States. And this is the part where, once again, the fact it isn't funny. It wasn't funny when it happened. And they all thought, oh, here's the big joke. And we're going to put a regular guy, as if he is one, in the White House. And it'll be real funny to watch him go after them liberals and drive them crazy. Right up until he becomes a national embarrassment again by creating two equal sides involved in an argument instead of the Nazis and the resistance to them. These are not equal sides. Oh, yes, there's been violence on all sides. Don't know how much more starkly I can say this than just to say, resisting Nazis isn't violence. It's vital. It is fighting an enemy.
There's a lot to be said for Donald Trump's embarrassing, and that's the only way to call it. And I'm not taking some kind of liberal stance, because you know how I feel about those people.
Well, the conservatives are abandoning him anyway.
The thing is that Donald Trump, as the President of the United States, once again has embarrassed the office and what it means. And even the symbolism of what a president, quote unquote, is supposed to do.
Yep.
And he failed miserably in doing it again. By actually equating and saying the magic words on both sides and emphasizing it immediately afterwards on both sides with his, there is nothing acceptable about what he said yesterday. And I found it really, really laughable, while being equally nauseating, that somebody who I've reviled since I first heard his name and saw his face, David Duke, actually said afterwards as his statement to him, "Just remember who got you here."
Yeah, right.
Oh, okay. Them's his fighting words, Sonny. Except for the fact that David Duke is already a known loser, and he thinks, even though he's in his moment of glory, that he's going to gain any traction from this. I don't think so, because mm-hmm. you spent your life hiding underneath the good old sheet of the KKK.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, Donald Trump has proven time and time again, and I don't think anybody really needs to have any more lessons about how inept and unqualified he is to do anything, and I mean anything, than by yesterday. Yesterday was a very simple process. You could have walked in there, I could have walked in there, anyone could have walked in there and simply uttered the words, "This is not acceptable."
Yep.
The damnation point would be pointing at who brought this to happen, who created it, who started it, call it what you want. You know I'm no fan of the left. You know I'm really no fan of Antifa and Black Lives Matter and all those other bullshitters, because I look at them the same way I look at the assholes on the right. They're all just waiting to stir the shit pot. But this was sanctioned by the, quote, white supremacy movement. I refuse to use the word Nazis. Nazi is reserved for Germany and for the Gestapo.
True enough.
And we're going to put it that way. You and I have talked about it. A misappropriation of language and co-opting is not necessary, especially because you and I understand the word Nazi better than anyone else.
Right.
These are not Nazis. You know, your grandfather's kids or great-grandfathers fought and died to prevent Nazis from appearing in the United States and creating what they created in Germany, where Nazism begins and ends. What this is just sheer ignorance, willful obstinacy, and obviously raging racism. And yeah. I'm not getting up and waving any flags of lefty anything. I'm calling it like I see it. And that's what this is. And the smartest thing and one of the wisest moments was from a woman who I know vaguely, who's a singer in a band that I love dearly, who said and I love the way she framed it. She said, I hope nobody thinks that I'm naive, but wouldn't it have been best maybe if in knowing that these assholes were going to have this march and rally in Charlottesville, wouldn't it have been best to make sure that they got absolutely no coverage and no traction, no attention, nobody shows up to protest against them. So that way, it's just them in their little cluster, and they would have all gone home really flustered, but nobody gave a shit and nobody paid attention, and that would have been the end of it.
Right.
You know, to a great degree, she is 150% correct. Of course, there's the counter that, well, you have to protect people from this kind of thing. Yes, but you also don't protect them by having people ready to fight. And that, unfortunately, is where Antifa always goes wrong, because they're there to fight. Not in the positive sense of shouting down. They're just ready to fight. They're no different. They really aren't. And let's face it, they're not exactly the right or correct representatives of people who are truly progressive, because they are obviously not great fans of women.
Yeah.
They are definitely not fans of Jews. They never made – no one made any kind of references to the swastika and, of course, the Jewish star on the white supremacist little march handbill or whatever you want to call it, their little propaganda poster. They didn't decry that. You know, it was simply Black Lives Matter showed up. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, John, Black Lives Matter is an anti-police group.
Yeah, you could posit it that way, sure.
Who is it that's going to protect anyone out of all of this?
Yeah, right. Well, and you know, there was a certain irony in the fact that while you had certainly, I mean, the most horrific event that happened over the weekend was when the car was driven by one of these skinhead punks right through a group of protesters, a group who was simply there walking down the street, marching in solidarity, and killed a woman and injured 19 people, put a bunch of them in the hospital in critical condition. But on the other side, one of these Antifa idiots walked up to a reporter, a female reporter, like you said, they seem to have a little problem with women, walked up to a female reporter for The Hill, the congressional newspaper, and punched her.
Need I say more?
Right. So... three quick things, and we've got a whole bunch to get into. We'll get into some music coming up as well. But the Nazi thing aside, I thought it was nice that John Dingell, former congressman from Michigan, if memory serves correctly, put up a tweet yesterday. This man is in his 90s, and he put up a tweet that said, I signed up to fight Nazis 73 years ago, and I'll do it again if I have to. Hatred, bigotry, and fascism should have no place in this country, period.
These are the kinds of things that the president of the United States, the moment this thing started, before it even escalated, and that's what everybody seems to forget, before it even escalated, he should have put the kibosh on it.
Yep.
But he didn't. He is the one who fostered this. He is the one who played down to what you and I have always referred to as the lowest common denominator. And that's what these people are, except for the fact that they're not the truly lowest common denominator, because like we said, they're not poor people from the sticks, you know, none of that, save for the retards from Duck Dynasty, who are incredibly well-to-do nowadays.
Yeah, right. But,
you know, these are all polo shirt-wearing dumb fucks, you know? That's all, you know, big mouths, little dicks.
Yep.
That's what it always boils down to.
Which was my second thing, because one of the best moments, and they replayed this one on TV a lot, it was caught live by one of the CNN cameras, and I'll trash CNN in a second, but this was one they actually did right, because they showed a scene on the streets where the clash was happening, and it was right at that line between the idiots and the protesters, and one of the idiots walked up and punched a girl Now, it could have ended there with just that image of one of these big, tough, neo skinheads walking up and punching a girl. But the great thing that happened right after that is that she turned around, arms flailing, and went after his ass. And the look on his face as he had to turn and run from the girl he just hit was exactly emblematic of what you just said. Tiny penis, tiny brain equals this kind of shit. And she beat the crap out of him, and good for her for doing it.
He drives a pickup truck. They all do.
Of course. And the last thing is, and this was just, again, part of the embarrassment that is cable news, I saw this happen in real time. Jesse Jackson was invited on as a guest.
Oh, no.
And he was fine, believe it or not, but the woman who was anchoring, she was trying to explain that that President Donald Trump was getting heat from all sides, that he was getting heat from the left and getting heat from the right for not calling out and using the words white supremacists or white nationalists. And she was explaining this to try to get an answer out of Jesse Jackson. And she actually said to him, you know, they're angry because he didn't call a spade a spade. And I damn near fell off the couch.
Well, yeah, it's funny because I was watching CNN for a brief moment yesterday, and they had that woman who is a Republican but very anti-Donald Trump. I can never remember her name.
Anna Navarro.
Thank you. And some guy who was a commentator for CNN. I couldn't tell if he was a conservative shill or what, because he referred to David Duke on the air as white trash.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And was ranting anti-David Duke, but then he was, you know, trying to mollify her about Donald Trump, and he too used the phrase it was Anna Navarro who used the phrase, let's call a spade a spade.
I think we need to retire that one. It's never used in a situation where it makes any sense anymore. So
I'm taking it back.
You're retaking it back? Oh, for life.
I'm sorry, you know what? When it comes to Jesse Jackson, fuck him too.
I don't forgive
and I don't forget.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
New York. Yeah. I remember these things.
Yeah.
So do a lot of others like us.
Yeah. Hymietown never did go over real well.
So fuck that guy too.
There you go. And as we get away from this and into music just a little bit, there are some things going on, and I've heard some new music that's starting to make me really excited about a lot of the directions that things are starting to go in. Now, it would be nice if they got a lot more notice than they do, and we weren't constantly just given pop garbage on the radio, but there are a couple of trends that are really cool. Now, one that I'm going to hand over to you, because I need a little background. This is the only one that that we're going to talk about this week that I will say I liked it, but I'm not sure I get it. I'm not sure I understand it. Tell me a little bit about it, Anton Barbeau.
Well, we've talked about Anton before. Anton, first of all, Anton's in our age range. So I think that's part of why you probably like it. He comes from the same school, broad school, that you and I do. He's definitely a disciple of Sid Barrett, and Robin Hitchcock. He could be the Americanized version of both, melded together, which is not that far apart to begin with. He put out an album that you and I both were quite fond of. He's very good at what he does. I would dare to say he is, and if he's listening, please forgive the phrase, the neo-psychedelic classicism.
Okay.
That's how I would phrase it, because he writes in a very classic rock style. He's definitely of that school of the Beatles and of the Who, the Pink Floyd, but then goes right into, you know, the Robin Hitchcock XTC kind of world, certainly the XTC world. But his new record, I think what is interesting about the new record is that he's venturing into an area that he hasn't gone into before, which is the more, I don't even know how you'd want to define it, because I'm picking up on one particular influence on this record, and that's the band Traffic, who I absolutely love.
Okay.
And the new single, Secretion of the Wafer, which, come on, I mean, that's just funny. that is just plain funny.
Yeah.
If you think about the wordplay, it's from the brand new EP called Heaven Is In Your Mind. It was originally going to be called Anton Is In Your Mind, which is would even be funnier because I get the joke no matter what.
Yeah.
Now, Heaven Is In Your Mind actually is the title of – all right, let me see if I can explain this right. I don't want to confuse anyone. Traffic's second album was called Mr. Fantasy in England. It was initially released here as Mr. Fantasy with a different cover and singles that had not been on the first album. Songs like Paper Sun and Hole in My Shoe were on the American pressing of Mr. Fantasy. Somewhere along the lines, United Artists decided to keep the cover but change the name of the album to Heaven Is In Your Mind.
Okay.
And that's the version that was actually reissued as a CD. I have the original United Artists LP from the mid to late 60s where the cover says Mr. Fantasy, but the label actually says Heaven Is In Your Mind, which is really outstanding. I got lucky on a freakish copy.
Yeah.
So the version that you'll find of Heaven Is In Your Mind, the album or the CD, is that titled version. Mr. Fantasy is on Island Records. It's a different cover, and it doesn't have, like I said, Hole in My Shoe. It doesn't have Paper Sun. There's a couple of other songs that are left off. Now, Anton just started getting into it, but he didn't realize that Heaven Is In Your Mind is a Traffic track.
Okay.
So that makes it even funnier and even more clever because it was unconsciously done. The bottom line is that Anton Barbo is a master of the classic rock genre. He goes from the poppy psychedelic era to now he's going into the textured psychedelic era because that is how Traffic started, especially on those first two albums. You know, Dave Mason was a bit more of the proggy rock or what would become prog rock thing. Winwood was still going through his steps of psychedelia. After all, he was only, what, 18, 19 years old at that point.
Yep.
So Anton is a student of neo-psychedelic pop classicism, and he's mastered it.
The pressure built, it built and built. The pleasure gold in the form of another from the mouth of the maker comes. The secretion.
With his use of language, but also with the way he skewers a pop tune, because he doesn't write them in the standard way. And you listen to Secretion of the Wafer, and you will understand exactly what I'm talking about, because it's not your three chords structure in a way where they go forward, then you take two of the chords to create the bridge, and play the three chords backwards to make the chorus. He skewers things. And if you're good at doing that, you're a master.
Okay, yeah, and I'll have to give it another listen through, but I watched the video as well, and of course, as the title might suggest, there's a whole lot of heavy duty Catholic imagery that's on display in that. So I'm trying to reconcile what's going on in the song with what was going on in the video. So I'll have to give it another couple of watches.
Go for it. I mean, once the song sticks in your head, that is when the job is done.
Gotcha. And we'll move from there into a couple of other things that are going on musically, because there was one that I loved. There's a song called Garage Sale from a band called Populux.
Yes.
These guys, I mean, you want to talk about, again, not just the song craft, but the studio craft that went into making this. It sounds so much fun.
Well, the beauty of going from Anton Barbo into Populux is yet again more of the Andy Partridge school. And you could tell that,
yeah,
Rob Shapiro, who is the maven behind Brooklyn's Populux, big shout out to the homeland.
Very nice.
Represent. Bullshit. I'm more Shaolin. You know that. Just because I was born in Brooklyn does not make me of Brooklyn, okay?
Yeah.
I am Staten Island through and through, my friend. Rob Shapiro is definitely somebody who you could say sat at Andy Partridge's lotus feet and learned from the great master of Swindon. Because listen to the way you were talking just now about the production. Listen to the way the guitars sound,
yep,
and the chord progressions. He has definitely worked his way through. And I've got to ask him one of these days directly, what's your XTC cycle? Because to me, it sounds like he's worked his way through Go To, Drums and Wires, and Black Sea as his points of reference. Because once XTC got to English Settlement, they were far more progressive in the sense of, okay, now they're a lot more acoustic based and pastoral sounding, and on to Mummer, which was completely acoustic, and so on and so forth. But the really weird and skewered stuff starts, I mean, well, they were just really fast and poppy on white music, but Go To is where shit gets weird.
Yeah.
And XTC turns into the XTC we begin to know and really love, because that's the album that had Are You Receiving Me and Crowded Room and Jumping in Gomorrah. You know, and the rhythm, you know, all of those songs, that's that period. So, you know, and of course, Drums and Wires is what put them on the map, because that's Making Plans for Nigel and Life Begins with a Hop and Helicopter and 10 Feet Tall. You know, Rob Shapiro writes these wonderfully obtuse pop songs, but the lyrics are incredibly pointed and poignant, and I think they fit the here and now, because he's a very astute watcher of the news and what's going on in life in general. You know, he has a wife and family, and you know, he's very concerned with the way things have been, are, and are going. Garage Sale, I think, says a lot more than people really realize.
Well, the other thing that struck me about it in terms of the way that this song sounds is that there is, and I think it's only there on the chorus, I'll have to listen to it again to know for sure, but there's a soaring harmony on the, I believe it's on the fifth. I mean, it's way up high, and it melds beautifully with the lead vocal in it, and it just, it's been done before, and it, that kind of thing, you made the comparison to XTC, and I think that's where a lot of it resides, but it works, and it just, it adds the exact proper dimension without turning the song into a barbershop quartet. You know what I mean?
Well, that's the thing. He's also a student, obviously, of the Beatles. And the Beatles, yeah, knew how to do those very unusual and the just right or very satisfying harmonies, or ending a song on a diminished ninth chord major.
Right.
You know, because it just fits.
Which, by the way, and a lot of people don't know this because on the album it wasn't there, that's where Her Majesty ends. Have you heard the version where it plays the chord at the end?
No.
That's it. It's a diminished ninth, and it just hits perfectly, and it's not what you would expect, but when it hits, you go, damn, that's nice. I've got it. I'll send it to you.
I was thinking of the end of Meet the Beatles.
Yeah, right.
What's the one, you know?
Yeah, it won't be long.
Is it?
Yeah, it hits that chord at the end. It is. It won't be long. Yep. That's the one.
See, kids, and I can't read or write music, but I know what the fuck I'm hearing.
That was kind of an interestingly timed tune as well. That was one of those that it really put Ringo to work. But yeah, it's that same style. And of course, where did the Beatles learn it? From the Everly Brothers.
Right, with the harmonies, without a question, it was the Everly Brothers. But funnily enough, by Paul McCartney's own admission, and even Lennon's admission in certain interviews, you know, they would steal things from the likes of Bing Crosby.
Right,
you know,
right.
you know, with the way they would phrase things or the way they would do certain things. Even George Martin said, you know, ending on a sixth, "She Loves You" ends on a sixth. And he said that was corny, but they said, but it works for the song.
Yep. Right. Yeah. So as long as it works, life is good.
That's the bottom line. It's about the song. And that's the great thing of the band like Populux, which I think their name is very apt because it's deluxe pop. It's complex. It's thought-provoking. At the same time, it's completely embraceable, familiar for us, digestible pop that you can embrace completely.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt about it. So you definitely got to check that one out. And that brings us right around to an interview that D.W. Dunphy did this week with a woman who has one of my favorite voices in that sort of indie pop realm, because she doesn't ever try to get cutesy and do things she doesn't have to do. Lisa Michaels, all of the songs that she has, every time I hear her voice come out of the speakers, I start to smile. It's just right.
There's something about her that the word delightful.
Yes, yes.
You know, that's the only word. I don't know if it's because of her very bubbly, but not cutesy.
Right.
But her bubbly and effervescent natural personality always shines through in the songs. And then when you read her in conversation with someone, especially like Dunphy, who always gets the best out of people. And I don't know how many times we've said this, but he really is a master of the interview by virtue of being able to do this. You know, she's one of those people and artists who just – it's all positives. It's always positives. Even in the songs that are a little bit more deeper seeking of meaning, that may be more – there's more than meets the eye. We hear it in one way, but what she might have been thinking would be something else, but it's up to us to interpret and perceive.
Yep.
No matter what she does, there seems to be a spark and a feel of hope and positivity.
It never did before, so nothing's changed. Now I'm thinking it's about time to explain how I'm doing, yeah. I really want you to get just where I am. Now I've taken on a Ferris wheel so I can keep from falling.
Incredibly hardworking musician, you know, and she is just nonstop at it. And that's what I find so enjoyable about what she does. And plus, if you've ever listened to any of the co-op communiques, then you would know her material, you know. And that's what I love about the fact that, you know, I've been able to be on the same compilation with somebody like her.
You know,
she just absolutely, you know, she's great. She really is. And God, she's got such an infectious smile.
Right.
That's the other thing, you know. It's nice to see an artist who doesn't scowl in every one of their photos. Like when I'm pictured, because, you know, great artist that I am, I make Sting look like the piker that he is.
Of course.
He's all fucking in a tantric manner and counting his money. You know, I got a lot to scowl about. Fuck all y'all.
Yeah, but yeah, you're right. She's got a terrific smile, and that's another thing. I mean, there is this hateful thing that goes on right now in the selfie world that women do, and I wish they would stop.
Don't say the duck lips. Please don't say the duck lips and then doing like the gang thing with the finger, like a pseudo peace sign or a British fuck you, whatever.
Right.
What the fuck is that?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, the reason for the kissy face, duck face thing is twofold. Number one, it makes you stick your chin out, which makes your double chin go away. And the other thing is it makes your cheeks look tighter. But the thing is, I think what somebody figured out was, oh, it's a way that I can make my 40-year-old self look 25 and fun again. And no, it doesn't. It makes it look like you're trying too hard. But she doesn't do that. I mean, that's the whole point. She just smiles for a picture, and it's great.
Well, you know, let's stop for a second and talk. Yes, she does, because she's absolutely adorable.
Yep.
I don't think there's anything wrong with saying that she's absolutely adorable. But again, it's her positivity that shines through in her photos. And in her smile, there's a genuineness about it.
Right.
And that genuineness goes into the music. So that's the beauty of pure pop for now people, you know? But let's get back to this fucking duck lips, you know, peace sign thing in the photos, because I do have an axe to grind with it. That just says two things to me. If you're motioning with your hand, hand job and blow job with the pouty lips.
There you go.
That's what that means. Does that sound sexist? I don't think so. How many of these women look like they're ready for some fun?
Exactly. Right. So it's definitely a mixed messaging kind of thing going on there. But yeah, either way, just take a picture. I mean, if you really must take a selfie at all, just take one. You don't have to have some kind of...
Concerning us and me making that statement, ratings through the roof.
That's right. It'll be, I take only the best selfies. Great selfies. It's crazy. There's a couple of other things we want to get into before we get in our heads for this week. And we're going to talk a little foreign language when it gets in our heads, but we'll get to that in just a little bit. But as we always have talked about, Rob, you and I, the fact is that there's a little bit of everything on Popdose. And we talk a lot about the music, but there's book columns and there's interviews and there's movies and TV are discussed elsewhere as well. And politics comes into it, but I love what Ted Azregadu, he's always been a terrific politics writer, but what he's been doing lately has been...
it's beyond description of phenomenally great is what it is.
Thank you.
I mean, really, you sit there and you read this, and you know what? You could take any moron who's out there, and there are plenty, sit him down in front of this, and the rudimentary, just a little info about me section.
Yes.
Definitely. It's so well-structured because it really is... The perfect what would you call it? Crash course to who the game players are right now in the whole Russia side story. Because you notice we haven't touched that. We've been focused on this disaster known as Charlottesville. We didn't even talk about North Korea. By the way, kids, we're still not going to nuclear war.
Yeah.
Telling you right now, you called it ages ago. We're not going to war. It ain't going to happen.
No. And yeah, that's one thing that was said over the last couple of days that I think is more worthwhile than anything else that's going on is with all this bluster and bullshit that's going on, our military stance has not changed one whit, nothing. So this idea that we're on some kind of war footing with North Korea, well, if it is, it's news to the military.
And by the way, if we had to go to war with North Korea, so to speak, we would blast them back into the Stone Age.
Yep.
I'm pretty sure. I don't think Kim Jong-un is going to survive this. But getting back to Ted's column, though, which is far more important than a fucking crazy little man on the other side of the world.
And a crazy little man on this side of the world, yeah.
You mean a crazy fat man? Or as I commonly refer to him as Orange Prick. That's my name for the guy.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know, the way it's laid out is very simple. You have, here are the two game players. It's almost like Rock'em Sock'em political robots, Mueller and Trump. And it's almost like flipping over a baseball card.
Yes.
And here's stats. And I love the way he did that. He gave a background, a story. This is what's been happening. This is what's been going on. And these are all the facts that go along with both characters in the game.
Yeah, and he doesn't pull any punches with it either. So, you know, it's all set up in one of those, like, LinkedIn About Me pages, and it goes through. And this week's column is about Bob Mueller and Donald Trump. And the fact that Mueller has taken so many shots from the administration, given the fact that he has the CV that Ted writes down in this column, it just makes the whole thing ever more insane and ridiculous. The fact that they're trying to siphon off some of the credibility that this man has built over his career. It's incredible.
And the thing is that you know, Trump has absolutely no credibility, nor has he ever.
Right.
And that's the part that mystifies me and that no one ever seems to talk about that. What has he done? He's failed in business numerous times, gone bankrupt numerous times, had a book ghostwritten for him. He has managed to offend, and we're talking about all the years that he was just a terror in New York City alone.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about the 37 or so years that I've heard that fucking name. And... you know, he's just been an embarrassment for all New Yorkers. He's the worst elements of New York, you know. I would probably sing a different song about my absolute hatred of Donald Trump if he had been born poor or, you know, working class, working middle class, whatever. But he was always a rich cocksucker. He's always been really bottom of the – it's interesting because he acts like someone – who comes from the streets and had to fight his way for every little crumb, and someone you can admire for having that kind of don't care, fuck you kind of attitude. But he's not. He's a rich piece of shit human being. He's the lowest of the low.
He's a product of a military school
that he paid, his parents paid his way through.
Yeah, because he kept getting into fights with the kids at the high-class private school. Now, granted, boy, if there's anything that'll give you street smarts, it's a fight in a high-class private school.
You know, all I can think of is that, that wonderful gag that was done on WWF years ago. I don't know if you remember when Shane McMahon started appearing on the show with his father doing the whole, you know, mean streets of Greenwich. And they all come out in J. Crew wear, you know,
right.
Got the shirts on, rolled up sleeves, you know, the matching striped pullover vests and, you know, chinos and you know, like Bass Region loafers.
Yeah.
That to me is like the Trump way of doing things.
That's, you know, brilliant.
That was probably the last gasp of when WWF had something sort of funny to introduce into it.
Yeah.
Because that's when, you know, I think that was when WCW was still out there. And of course, we all know I'm a WCW, NWA, AWA kind of guy. So, you know, but that was one that made me chuckle. You know, in the days of Hunter Hearst Helmsley and when China was still his valet, quote unquote, you know, that was. God, that's already 20 years ago and changed.
Oh, unbelievable. Yeah, time does march on.
But Donald Trump, let's put it that way.
But one more thing about Charlottesville, and it leads back into this because there's something that, again, I think either everybody's missing or nobody on TV news wants to say it because they keep kind of shrugging their shoulders about this. And this is kind of the latest development in all this, is that in cleanup, for the fact that Donald Trump, who right now, and this is pertinent, is on vacation at his whatever, at his golf club in New Jersey.
He's so, actually now at Trump Tower costing New York City.
Oh, is he back in New York City?
$375,000 a day until Wednesday now.
Right. So while all that's going on, he's not in Washington, D.C. So he gives that stupid-ass statement yesterday where he doesn't call out the white supremacists and the neo-Nazis. And so the White House has to now play cleanup. So they put out a statement either late last night or early this morning. And it was words to the effect of, well, you know, the president said he hates racism and bigotry and there's no place for that. And they said, and that includes the white supremacists and the KKK and the neo-Nazis. And they ran down the list of them. But the interesting thing about that, the release of that statement, is they won't say who wrote it. They won't say which White House official is responsible for this statement. And I have a theory about this. I think that there is so much fear right now. And I mean, everybody's talked about the revolving door in the White House with Scaramucci being gone after 10 days and all of this other shit. I think that what has been going on for these 7 months is that he, whenever he's in the White House and is forced with the prospect of having to do actual work, it irritates him to such a point that he evades it whenever he can. And when somebody forces him to do something, all he does is rip people and throw tantrums and start yelling and screaming. We've heard the stories about, you know, the reporters who are walking by windows and hearing the screaming going on inside the White House between Trump and his advisors and all of this shit. So I think what's happened is they don't want to interrupt him while he's on vacation because they'll get ripped for it. And they don't want to put their name on it because if somebody in the White House writes a statement like that, even in support of him, if it says one word he doesn't like and it gives the impression that he doesn't really like David Duke or some shit like that, that when Trump gets back to Washington, D.C., he's going to spend an hour and a half tearing that guy a new asshole and then probably fire him. So I think they're terrified to put their name on anything. The only one who put her name on anything was Ivanka.
That's because she can't get fired.
Exactly. And he won't anyway because he's got the hots for her.
Now, there's one more thing that I don't know if you've seen this yet, but this kind of puts a lot into perspective. It doesn't surprise me. It doesn't faze me, shock me, any of that. If I am anything, it's one of those rare moments where I will just simply say, told you so. Not in the obnoxious way of, told you so. No, this is a told you so. And this apparently is not fake either. Cassandra Fairbanks, former Bernie Sanders spokesperson, is now the white nationalist speaker for the August 17th Boston version of Today in Charlottesville. So apparently these assholes are going to do this up in Boston, or at least hold one of their little white national rallies, and she's going to be one of their spokespeople. Are you surprised? I'm certainly not, because that's how they portray themselves to me in just so many ways.
Yep. Yeah. It's all crap. And I just, it needs to stop. Somebody needs to put the grown-ups back in charge. And I saw somebody, and I don't know that I necessarily agree with this sentiment, but I saw this sentiment expressed over and over again yesterday on Facebook and Twitter. I just want an adult back in charge. I don't even care if it's Mike Pence, you know?
Yeah, I don't, you know, I don't really know how I feel about that idea, because he's just so much more of what's been wrong to begin with.
Yeah, true.
It just goes back to the, okay, we got rid of Trump, but now it's this symptom that we've been trying to do away with. You know, and now I don't have a problem by any stretch, by any means, by any question, with anyone who is deeply religious, and that includes Christians or whatever. You know, I'm not somebody who has ever subscribed to going on a regular basis, in my case, to temple. My father was very Catholic, especially towards the end of his life. Constantly asked me if I wanted to join him to go to church, and I very politely said him, thanks, but no, I have no interest. Yeah. You know, it's just a case of, I don't need to pray in a place that I have to pay to go to feel close to God. I have a very strong, unflapping, unwavering, deeply rooted belief in God. God as the all-being and so on. You know, I believe in God, not a God, but I believe in the man upstairs. Pure and simple. You want to come at me for that, by all means, please do. You know, and even though I don't like being proselytized at, because it's very tiresome to listen to, and it's also 99 times out of 100 said and done in such an ignorant manner, that's why it is proselytizing. You're throwing shit in where you shouldn't. If you want to have a religious discussion with someone as to why you believe these tenets versus the tenets that I grew up with or I embrace, that's fine. Let's have that discussion, because it's like discussing why I think the Mets are superior to the Marlins. You know, it's one view versus another.
Yep.
That's a discussion. I think part of the big problem that we have is that, and I was having this conversation with somebody this morning, is that we have a lot of people out there who don't believe in anything. And I'm talking about the hardcore, quote-unquote, atheists, who are a contradiction in and of themselves, because atheism is a belief system.
Yep.
Your non-belief is a belief. And they're such angry, bitter people that they want nobody to have peace or joy in their lives. And you can say what you will about the concept of religion and of God, but if you have something that you believe in from the time that you're small, that you've based yourself through, you know, it may not carry you as being part of your everyday existence, but if it's part of your roots, you have a certain solid foundation. You know, I'm not somebody who, I don't do a Tim Tebow, and I'm not knocking Tim Tebow by any means,
right,
because he's a very good guy and a very kind person, and I'll get to that in a second. You know, but I have faith in God, and that gives me a certain sense of calm and you know, focus and who I am. You know, my sense of spirituality is very strongly rooted, so that makes me unflappable, even in the worst moments of my own personal life. These people are so angry and bitter, they want dissent amongst everybody. You don't want anybody to have any sense of joy. You don't want people to say Merry Christmas. I have never been offended by somebody saying to me Merry Christmas because I'm Jewish.
Right.
That's ridiculous, you know? And that's petty. And that's what it is. It's pettiness. And, you know, the godlessness. And that's when I talk about godlessness. You know, well, we make jokes about, you know, well, the gays are all godless. We've heard that for years and years. No, no. Trying to beat God into them to turn them straight. No, you know, I'm not down with that. You know, if somebody's godless in general, I want to beat God into them. And I think the atheists need conversion therapy more than homosexuals do, because almost every one of my gay friends happen to be all very spiritual people. So
and most of the ones that I hang out with are also very happy. And you know what? That's great. Good for you. Be happy.
nice people. I don't care what your sexual preference is. I don't care what your political stripe is. And you and I talk about this all the time because that's a recurring theme with us, because it's about people and communicating. If you're a good person and you think in a rational manner, then these conversations are just that. They're conversations and points of view. But you get somebody who's an atheist and they're just these cynical fucks who hate everything and seemingly want to destroy everything. Then we got to beat God into it. But on the Mike Pence side of beating God into people, he's just a little too creepy for me. I don't...
No, I agree, but he's not Trump.
I'm not down with the guy. And I got to be honest, I would like there to be absolutely no remnants of anyone Trump administration in the next go-around. And my feeling is, I call it a hunch, my feeling is the next administration will be a Democratic one, just because of what, and I'm saying this in a very broad way, hopefully will be learned within these next 3 years, because we're still in the first year alone. However, if the left keeps going the direction that it's been going in, with its Bernie Sanders inflicted bullshit, then no, we're going to have 4 more years of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
There's no way around that. So people better get their heads out of the collective asses, pick up a Bible, start believing in God, and start, you know, pulling their shit together before we're all going to be sent blasted to hell.
Right. Well, and the thing is, my problem, and I went to a long time ago when I was like 19 or 20, I went to an American Atheist convention just to look around and see what the scene was and see what it was all about. And it took me about 10 minutes to realize that where I was a church. And I thought, oh, really? Why would I leave one church to go to another church? And my problem with the way that they pose things is the same reason that Carl Sagan, who is not a religious man at all, and as far as I know, didn't have any particular belief in God, but he also said the problem with a movement like the atheist movement is they pretend to know. The same way that a lot of really hardcore right-wing Christians pretend to know. They will tell you, it's not a belief in God. They don't believe, they know. And I think, no, you don't. you don't, because you can't. And there are people who are comfortable not knowing. I am one of those people. I don't think we're supposed to know. So, you know, it doesn't make any difference. But yeah, you're right, getting in other people's face about it. Look, whether I am an atheist, an agnostic, a Jew, a Christian, a Muslim, or whatever, December 25th is Christmas Day. And if somebody wishes me a Merry Christmas, even though I'm not a Christian, my thought is they're telling me, have a nice day on December 25th. Exactly. Thanks.
You know what? We, you know, even though I wasn't into it, because I just never was into it in general, you know, we had Christmas trees when, you know, after we lit the menorah.
Right.
Well, period. That was the way you did in my house. You know? And we always had my family together on Christmas Day because it was a centralized day that everybody was off and could get together. Like Thanksgiving, you know, you made the effort to, it's a family day. Why is it people can't, you know, conceive of that? Of course, the fucking wackadoo druids out there like to go, well, it's, you know, it's a pagan holiday. Okay, we get it.
But
you know?
Who cares? It doesn't matter.
Listen,
makes
if I was
no
a
difference.
Druid, I'd become a tree surgeon. Okay, that's fine. Yep. All well and good, you know, pray in bushes and shit like that. But,
right.
But the point is that, you know, when it comes to atheism, first of all, I don't believe in atheism. And second of all, atheists are just plain mean.
Yeah.
They're just dour people.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And if you listen to somebody long enough and then they slip in the fact that they're atheists, you connect all the dots in one fell swoop. It's kind of like getting that big blast you need at the end of Angry Birds blast when the rockets and the bombs go off because you've just cleared the deck. Because that's how it turns out. Time after time after time, and having conversations with atheists just get me nowhere. And well, I don't argue with them because I don't waste my time with them. You know?
Yeah. Well, you know, and here's the weird thing is that the people, and I know a few people like this. In fact, I was talking to a longtime friend of mine who I had not seen for a while about this just the other day, because I knew him 25 years ago as a Mormon, and he now calls himself an atheist, but he's not in that category. So it's one of the few times where that kind of life change, that sort of conversion to, actually turns somebody into less of a belligerent ass about it. You know what I mean? Because all he's saying is, look, all that they told me about God and religion, I don't believe that. And he's coming to terms with who he is, and that's fine. But he wasn't telling me as though, and so anybody who believes in God is now my enemy. He's just relaxed and cool, you know?
Well, also, you know, you got to remember something. When I say stuff, I'm in New York.
Oh, yeah, no. I get it.
Everybody's dickishness is magnified times 10. I mean, you know it. I know it.
Yep.
You know? And most of the people around me, when you know, certainly when friends of ours and our listeners who are in the New York tri-state area, they know what I'm talking about because they're of the tri-state area. So we know how suddenly, you know, people's balls become bigger, where 5 becomes 50. And,
yeah.
You know,
but my
humble shit.
My point was more about the conversion effect, because I have another good friend who long ago also went through a number of life changes. And the first thing was he quit drinking and went through AA and all of that. And then he quit smoking. And then he came out and, you know, went through, like I said, a whole bunch of different life changes. But the drinking and smoking thing, I quit smoking 16 years ago, almost 17 years ago, and I promised myself at the time, I am not going to be a dick about this. I am not a crusader. I don't give a shit if somebody smokes. If you want to smoke next to me in a bar, go ahead. I'm not going to sit there and go, you know, you really should stop that, because fuck me at that point for being an asshole. And so a lot of people who go through that sort of conversion, whether, you know, they put down alcohol or whatever, all of a sudden they become a crusader, and fuck crusaders.
Yep. I mean, I had a friend who, she did the same thing. She was a heavy drinker, smoker, drug taker. And, she became so unbelievably pompous that I actually had to say to her at one point, do you remember any of the conversations you and I have had over the years? Because you've become everything you said you hated in this world.
Yeah.
I mean, you are absolutely insufferable, and you seemingly have driven everyone else that you've known and or cared about or have cared about you away with this newfound righteousness and piety. And you're about to lose me too. So just hope you know that, you know, when I'm gone, I'm gone.
There you go. It is, on that happy note, now that we've solved politics and religion, we'll move on to In Our Heads.
Hang on a second, because my moral turpitude is nowhere near done. I'm already standing out. Hang on there, son. I'm standing here in the pulpit. I have my Bible in one hand, a sword in the other. And let me just say this much. Canada by Duran Duran should not have been a B-side. It should have been an A-side unto itself. One of the great songs of the earliest part of the 80s, you know? And how they fucked that up, I'll never know.
No. Okay. But yes, it does. There's the song that has been the pop song of the year so far, I guess. And I swear to you, this is true. I still haven't heard it. And I've been avoiding it like the plague because it's Justin Bieber. It's probably a decent pop song, but Despacito has become this force of nature. And it's been, the video's been viewed like 8 billion times, like twice for everybody on the planet, whatever it is. And that's fine. But when people make fun of it, they make fun of it by the fact that everybody knows the title of the song and can sing that word in the song, and then they lose it after that because it's all in Spanish, which is fine. But it got me to thinking, because some of my favorite songs over time have either been translated into another language from English or originally written in another language. And there is, English is not as sort of stark, I guess, and regimented as German, but it's got enough of that Germanic sort of...
If you say Major Tom or Der Kommissar, I'm going to reach through that phone.
No. But you know, what I was getting to is English isn't as it's not as stark as German, but it's got enough of those elements that it loses a lot of the sort of song-like nature of the Romance languages, the pure Romance languages, Italian, Spanish, French. Those languages sound prettier to me as an English speaker. And I speak some Spanish, almost no French, almost no Italian, but I love to listen to them. And I remember as a kid watching Sid Caesar talk about the voices that they used to do when they were doing the mock foreign languages on your show of shows back in the early 50s. And he said, once you get the song of a language, you can mock anything. You know, you can do mock Spanish, mock Italian, mock whatever. And so listening to a song in those languages that already have that sort of song-like quality about them is something that appeals to me. And last night, sitting at the bar, They have one of those jukeboxes where you can use your smartphone to, you know, pick the next song. And I put on one that I think the only pop culture piece of this is that it was in The Big Lebowski, the Gypsy Kings version of the Eagles Hotel California.
Welcome to the Hotel California. Such a lovely place. Such a lovely place. Welcome to the Hotel California. Such a lovely place. Such a lovely place.
And I just, you know, I remember Hotel California being a big part of my childhood, but listening to the, I love the Gypsy Kings anyway, and listening to those guys sing that song and play the guitars in that fashion, that sort of South American just jam, it sounds fantastic to me. So there's a bunch of songs I like that are all foreign language songs, which is where this is all going. And I figured I would toss that at you and ask if there are any songs like that, either translated or originally recorded in another language, that you really dig.
I'm going to try and do this in a linear manner. So I'm going to number them.
Okay. Okay.
One, when you said the name of this Justin Bieber song, which I too have never heard, but I couldn't even tell you what's been on the top of the charts for years. I really have no knowledge. You said the name of the song, and I thought right away, Bumble. Ironically, just this afternoon we were watching the end of a three-hour German movie called Toni Erdmann. And what I've always loved about German is the fact that German is far closer to English,
yes,
than any of the Romance languages. I can and I do speak some German, you know, so that's a big plus for me. It's very helpful, and I do speak French. I don't like the French, but I speak. ironic, isn't it? I speak French and German. You know, all I need is Italian.
Yeah.
Then two of the Axis and the Collaborators. Number three, when you were talking about, you know, songs that translate, the funny thing is a lot of the songs that were pop hits in the early 80s that were all German, because we had a slew of them back to back to back. You had Der Kommissar by Falco.
Yep.
You had Major Tom by Peter Schilling, and you had 99 Luftballons by Nina.
Nina, right.
Translated doesn't work. It just doesn't sound good. You have to sing them in German. You know, 99 Schlafballons. That's the way, you know. And the same thing goes, you know, alles klar, Herr Kommissar. Because that also goes back to the whole Kraftwerk thing. I am the operator on my pocket calculator. You know,
right.
Bahn auf der Autobahn.
And, of course, the Numbers song that Kraftwerk did, that I think was a lot of our introduction to them. I think that may have been their only hit.
Possibly. But, I mean, the thing is that, for me, German pop was the one that always worked. Now, there are a lot of non-English songs that I find really, really, that I actually love. My favorite might possibly still be Sukiyaki by Kyu Sakamoto. Came out in 1963 on Capitol Records and was an accidental number one. And it was a classic. I mean, it's a great song. It's a great melody. You know, I love that. I also love the original Volare by, what's his name? Domingo Meduño. I think that was his name.
Which, by the way, the Gypsy Kings also did a great version of.
Let me think of some other non-English. I mean, I really do love the original German versions of Major Tom and Der Kommissar. You know, it's funny because, you know, doing mock English, that also led me to another thought. You know, in the song Sun King, that's fake Spanish.
Oh, yeah, right. I actually played that for my Spanish teacher, my freshman Spanish teacher in high school. And he said, yeah, there's some stuff in there about how my heart is a gift to the world, but most of it's just gibberish.
Right, or, you know, like Albalacala Puse Puse in number 9.
Right.
You know, some kind of weird fake language made up. There are songs from the 70s that I just would not even bring up because they were just so horrific and so terrible and yet seemed to rule the airwaves. And my mother, with her knack for, you know, anything that was in the top 40, she was a sucker for, you know. Come Fridays or Saturdays, it was off to Kmart for the 99-cent singles.
Yep.
You know, the new singles came in that week, and these fucking songs were on the charts. Like, I mean, even though Una Paloma Blanca was a Spanish title, it wasn't sung in Spanish.
Right,
it was
just
a song, but there were two really awful songs when I was about 8 or 9 that were huge on the charts, and I mean fucking huge. Eris 2.
Oh, that horrible song.
Yeah.
Oh, it was so syrupy and just...
Donkey's dick. And then the other that I really fucking hated was, of all things, because I knew my mother would never let go of this one, there's a song in Hebrew called Bashana Avata, which means next year in Israel. And I just wanted to shoot her for doing that. I fucking hated that one too. I was like, could you torture me anymore? Oh, shut up. You got your new Elton John single.
Yeah.
The point.
We're right. And you mentioned Kyu Sakamoto. That was the first song in the United States that was sung completely in another language that hit number one. And a lot of people think it was La Bamba because that came out much earlier. I think that was 57 or 58. La Bamba didn't come close to number one. The highest chart position for it.
The B-side of Donna.
Right. Donna made it to number two. La Bamba made it to 22. That was it.
And what you were saying before about, you know, knowing some of the words. Well, unfortunately, I know every fucking word to La Bamba because, as I told you in that story, my first road trip with my girlfriend, God rest her soul, and her family on our way to South Carolina, you know, as you go from town to town and a certain percentage of miles, one station would fade out, another one would fade in.
Mm-hmm.
And during the summer of 87. So the only songs that were played over and over were Luca, La Bamba, and The Power of Love. And fucking La Bamba in my sleep basically penetrated while I was sleeping in the back of the van. So I know every goddamn word to a song I really hate now.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So I know it in Spanish, you know, but then there's things like, you know, yeah, it's kind of fruity to pick these out, but, you know, Michelle by the Beatles. You know,
sure.
But that's easy. That's an easy one. The hard one, and one that I absolutely love, and I just truly love this song. And I love doing the song, and I fully intend to record the song. I did it once when I, years and years and years ago, when I got my first four-track cassette recorder. But now I intend to try and do it and do it in a kind of orchestrated version. Is Jennifer Juniper by Donovan,
because
the full verse is sung in French. And apart from the fact that it's a beautiful song, and it ends in such a magnificent way, with that gentle delivery of his in French, you know, it's just one of my favorite songs, and it's a very emotionally salient song for me. It's a song that's definitely, it's always lived in my heart. So, but that's sung predominantly in English with that one nice little twist in the end.
Yes, and it is gorgeous, and you know, anybody who's ever seen a picture of Jenny Boyd back from that era knows, yeah, she deserved to have a song written about her.
So did Patty.
Yeah. Patty had more than a few, but Jenny got her shot in too, so.
Sisters, whew.
Yeah, uh-huh. Well, let's see.
Ladies on every level, though, that's the best thing about them. They really, both of them are just lovely, lovely people.
Yeah, and with Patty, I mean, how many songs were written about her? Something was the first one.
I'll go you a couple better.
Okay.
Believe it or not. If I Needed Someone.
Okay, right. And then Something, and then Bell Bottom Blues, Layla. How many more? I mean, it was like every great song that was written about a woman, they were all Patti Boyd.
Really, you don't need to say more than that, do you?
Yeah, right. Well, listen, it was a great way to end our In Our Heads segment and a great way to end the show again. And boy, we covered a lot in this one. Rob Ross, always such a pleasure. This is why we get together on these afternoons to talk about this stuff. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, anytime. You know, it's always a joy and a pleasure for me to be able to vent my spleen.
You got it. Go look around elsewhere on Popdose. There's lots of great stuff out there. And we will do some more talking right here on Radio City next week on popdose.com.